Welcome back to Codex Radio. I'm your host, Endless Odyssey. And today we have episode 9, which is part 5 of our reading of You Died, the Dark Souls Companion. Today's episode represents the halfway point in our journey through this text, so if you've been enjoying it, rest assured, plenty more remains ahead. And I suppose if you haven't been enjoying it, then you can also take solace in the fact that we are winding down. I don't have any updates for you today regarding the show, so we'll just jump right into the reading. I give you part 5 of You Died, a Dark Souls Companion, by Jason Killingsworth and Keza MacDonald. Tour of Lordran, Painted World of Variamus, by Jason Killingsworth. For any museum-goer who has ever wondered about the purpose of that rope cordoning off space in front of a painting, the answer resides within the first cathedral you pass through in On Orlando. Museum security staff aren't worried about fingerprint smudges. Their primary concern is your safety, as they realize touching paintings can cause a dark magic to drag you into alternate realities from which it's difficult to pry yourself loose. Sounds like my experience interacting with video games. Provided you've paid a return visit to the Undead Asylum to retrieve the peculiar doll, interacting with the On Orlando painting will convey you to a bonus stage of sorts. From Software designed the painted world as a prototype during the early stages of Dark Souls pre-production. It appears they couldn't find a logical place to bake the completed stage directly into the geography of Lordran, so instead they found a free-floating pocket in which they could nestle their painted Easter egg. It's not hard to understand why Frum wanted to preserve this stage. The painted world has so much atmosphere. Milky half-light, snow-frosted terrain that crunches pleasingly underfoot, lonely crow squawks, corpses of hollows impaled on javelins, which I imagine the flocking crows see as an enormous party platter cocktail sticks. Beyond aesthetics, the prototype nature of the stage becomes evident in the range of architectural variation. You have waterlogged basements, maze-like segues between interior rooms and fortress ramparts, a cemetery courtyard that feels tailor-made to serve as a PvP dueling arena, the husk of a tower whose spiral staircase can be scaled by treasure hunters who feel like braving the crow demons for a chance to pick up the red sign soapstone and get a fabulous crow's eye view. There are two types of bridges, a rope one at the start and a stone one at the finish. It's hard to think of an architectural feature that doesn't appear in some form, as if Frum's level designers simply wanted a zone in which to prove them all out. The Painted World's boss, Crossbreed Priscilla, has the dubious distinction of being a favorite subject for Dark Souls fans who enjoy drawing naughty pictures. Without even trying to order up a plate of smut, doing an image search for Crossbreed Priscilla yields an eyebrow-raising batch of results. Dark fantasy indeed. I'm curious as to why. For those with an active erotic imagination, perhaps the notion of Priscilla's hinted-at origin story involving a romantic tryst between a human and a dragon, creatures as diverse as birds and bees, feels aberrant enough to add an element of risk and excitement. Or maybe the downy soft white fur covering much of her body transforms her into a walking approximation of the old bearskin rug lovemaking cliché. Maybe the way she turns invisible during the fight becomes the ultimate hard-to-get tease. I'll leave it to someone smarter than me to figure it out. Beginner's Pluck, How a Total Novice Beat Dark Souls, by Keza MacDonald. One of the biggest misconceptions about Dark Souls is that it's only for the super hardcore macho gamers looking to prove their mettle, players looking to test their already hardened skills. The challenge is too intimidating, runs this line of reasoning, for anyone else to contemplate attempting. Bandai Namco played on this idea with Dark Souls' marketing slogan, Prepare to Die, which, though successful in America, actually proved to be something of a turnoff for European players, if Dark Souls' early sales data is anything to go by. The difficulty is, disappointingly, often the first thing that comes up when people talk about the game, especially people who haven't played it much. It can give the impression that Dark Souls is basically a video game equivalent of a habanero pepper challenge. Are you tough enough to survive it? The whole principle is, in my experience, a total fallacy. I know plenty of people who aren't enormously interested in most video games, but who have totally cleaved to the Souls series. A friend of mine had a housemate, Amy, who had literally never played a video game before in her life, but was so intrigued by watching him play Demon's Souls that she picked up the controller for herself. Demon's Souls ended up being the first game she'd ever completed, and she loved it. There are a lot of stories that puncture the stereotype that Dark Souls is inherently forbidding to all but the hardcore. One such story is that of Kay, an American woman in her 30s who chronicled her wonderful Dark Souls journey on YouTube. One day in 2013, she and her boyfriend P sat down to play some Borderlands 2 co-op together, and her ineptitude at driving, specifically at using a twin-stick controller, inspired him to sit her down in front of Dark Souls and record her playing for laughs. Quote, "He was probably thinking it would be an episode or two of me being squished by things. And it was, at first," Kay told me. "I knew nothing about it other than the fact that it's very pretty and very difficult. He set the computer up and wouldn't tell me anything about what I was about to face. I think he hoped I would fail utterly and hilariously, but instead I was okay, I suppose. Not great. Slow to pick up the controls, but quick to understand the game's mechanics and story." The first episode went live on December 16th, 2013. Kay certainly doesn't help herself with her choice of character class. She picks Deprived, a class that starts completely naked and with all stats at an even 11. Most players would agree that it's the hardest starting class of all, especially for a beginner. It's wonderful watching someone with no idea what's about to happen throw themselves cheerfully at the undead asylum. Kay spends a good 10 minutes in the cell trying out the controls and figuring them out pretty quickly. She had played plenty of games before, of course, just not this kind of game. Quote, "My older brother and I used to get trotted off to my grandmother's house when we were little, and this would have been a supremely boring experience if we hadn't discovered my uncle's old room from when he was little," she says in one of her videos. He had left behind all of this old gaming stuff, games, Dungeons & Dragons books, choose-your-own-adventure books, all sorts. It's funny how many of my interests today I can trace back to my uncle. We didn't have much face-to-face interaction, but I got his hand-me-down interests. The first time Kay encounters the Asylum Demon, her poor character is still completely naked with nothing but a broken sword hilt. Unsurprisingly, it doesn't go well, but she responds with curiosity rather than despair. "My heart is pounding right now," she says, opening the door to face him again, heroically wielding the broken sword hilt with two hands. It does 2 damage with every hit, and she hasn't found Oscar and his Estus flask yet. "I guess this will be a long fight," she says. At the beginning, everything is new to Kay. The concept of soul retrieval, the controls, the bonfires, the inventory system, the lot. What makes it so compelling to watch for a longtime Souls fan is the awareness that every Souls player was once completely new, but after 100 hours in company of the game, we've all forgotten with what being uninitiated feels like. Watching a player as intelligent and inquisitive as Kay approach every new challenge with willingness and curiosity is an absolute treat. I wish I could say I'd been as calm and patient in my first hours with Dark Souls. Kay did not expect to get as involved with Dark Souls as she eventually did. Quote, "Admittedly, it was originally going to be one of those, hey, let's watch her suck at video games kind of thing, but after a few strangers watched and left comments on the first episode or two, it was no longer just a joke for friends," she tells me. "Plus, sometime around Undeadburg, I started to really like the game, so I decided to just play the game the way that I would if nobody was watching." There was one particular moment in the Undeadburg that totally sold Kay on the game. It was my encounter with the Black Knight when I was up on the roof and started throwing stuff down on him and trying to jump onto his head. "Oh man, that was a great fight," she says. "The fight was frantic, had me on the edge of my seat and went down to the wire. One hit from death, no more healing. I had thrown every item in my inventory at it. Arrows, firebombs, daggers. I had done a series of drop attacks from the rooftop and whittled him down to near death. I had to do one more. I did. And missed. All that was left was a suicide leap to land the killing blow, and I fell in love with Dark Souls in that moment." And play she did. Over the course of 88 episodes and almost 3 months on YouTube, Kay fought all the way to the killing of the first flame, gaining a pretty big following in the process. At every turning point, you feel like you're right there with her, like the moment she discovers sorcery, or when she decides to try going up the hill from Firelink Shrine, away from the gigantic skeletons. What's so captivating about watching Kay's video is that it really is like experiencing the game all over again for the first time, from the perspective of someone who hasn't so much as read a review. It's brilliant to see her go from someone who can't find her way around the controller to someone who can comfortably dispatch most of Dark Souls bosses in 5 or fewer attempts. It's also refreshing to watch someone play Dark Souls without constantly going on about how difficult it is. It isn't the challenge that attracts Kay to Dark Souls, it's the exquisite world-building, the mystery, the lore. Her observations on the game are a lot more interesting than, "Holy shit, this is tough." Quote, "I was constantly impressed with the world as a whole," she tells me. "Early on, I kept spotting a tower in the distance, the same tower each time, that marked the bridge where I'd fought the Taurus demon, but I encountered it from a different angle, with a different zone each time. Looking down onto Blighttown from Firelink and up from below, spotting the demon ruins from the tomb, Lower Undeadburg from above, Darkroot Basin from the forest, the Archive from the Parish from Sens. Over and over, I'd find myself looking back at places I'd been or spying new locations I hadn't yet traveled. It turns out, I think, that the sorts of these things I do like in games, which is to make a record of what I do, ask for help, and draw maps and diagrams, and read everything, and look at everything, really pays off in this style of game," she says. "The Souls games reward you for patience, and for observation, and for memory, and for exploration and attention to detail. It's that, with a really fun combat system layered on top of it. It was a good fit for my personality." Kay is wholly unbothered by Dark Souls' supposed macho image. "I see it differently," she says. "I think the game would be hard if you were impatient, if you neglected NPC dialogue, if you overlooked mechanics taught to you during the asylum escape. For example, I learned how to roll, then promptly forgot it was in my repertoire for 30 episodes. Luckily, a shield protected me until I remembered. I think the game tells you everything you need to know. Dark Souls doesn't hold your hand, but it points you in the right direction and says, I've given you all the tools you need to survive. Use them wisely. You go that way, and there are landmines. But Dark Souls gives you a manual for disarming them. But then the manual is in Swahili. But Dark Souls also gives you a Swahili dictionary. It expects you to listen, and to learn, and to improve. If I could do it, anyone with patience could. I don't think Dark Souls is brutally hard. It's challenging in a good way. I wish more games found this balance." Dark Souls has had a pretty big impact on Kay's life. It was the beginning of a YouTube channel that she and P have worked on together ever since, but she doesn't see completing it as something that's changed her. Quote, "I was 33 when I started the game and already had a good idea who I was," she says. "I knew I cared more about stories and characters than stats and big numbers. I knew I was calm, patient, analytical, and not very funny. I didn't know anyone was interested in watching someone like that. I'd love to say that through Dark Souls, I discovered some hidden quality about myself. It's the sort of game I can see having that effect on people. Maybe it gave me confidence that I could play more technically challenging games. Before, I'd tend to stick to story-driven games and, bar a few exceptions, avoid heavily strategic, skill-based games. One thing it has done, though, is bring her and P closer together. What started out as a joke for friends ended up being quite an important factor in their relationship." Quote, "I think it's fair to say that P learned something about me while I played this game," she says. "He knew I had a history playing games, but I think it surprised him how much I threw myself into the world. Maybe it's sappy, but video games like Dark Souls and working on this channel together made us closer. I haven't said anything on the channel, but we married last year." Kay has played plenty more games for her YouTube audience since. Her Dark Souls run, though, will always be special, both for her and for any Souls fan who enjoyed it. We might have started from different places, but ultimately the journey Kay goes through is the same as anyone's. Initial bewilderment and incompetence, gradual learning, and eventually mastery. It's a reminder that even if you're fluent in all of the buttons on an Xbox 360 controller, even if you've played hundreds of games before, we were all once total novices when it comes to Dark Souls. A Tour of Lordran, The Duke's Archives and Crystal Cave by Jason Killingsworth. You can see it from the Undead Burg below, perched high atop a hill above Von Orlando, the Duke's Archives. In fact, there is no loftier point in all of Lordran. If the notion of the Ivory Tower Academic is all about feeling high and mighty, the elevation of this sprawling library means you can take a break from your reading to step outside and get a breath of fresh air and look down on the whole of humanity. Dark Souls uses the Duke's Archives to rehash the shopworn video game trope about the gifted intellectual pursuing scientific progress so intently that he ends up unleashing a power that he is hopeless to control. In a fun twist, though, it's the beast Seath the Scaleless who plays the part of the devil-may-care scientist in Dark Souls. Seath has been experimenting with the potent magical properties of crystals and developing his sorceries and chasing his own elusive immortality. There's a wonderful transition that occurs over the course of the level as you move from an environment filled with ordered shelves of books into one such as the Crystal Cave just outside the archives, places that have been overtaken by jagged crystal shards jutting out at chaotic angles. This provides a subtly shifting visual context that mirrors the journey undertaken by Seath, a knowledge quest that seeks clarity but only causes the student to become increasingly unhinged as deeper exploration reveals unanticipated and indigestible realities. Whether intentional or not, the numerous facets of a piece of crystal provide an apt metaphor for the complexity of any intellectual riddle. Then again, it could easily be a metaphor for psychological breakdown, just as films will often depict a shattered mirror to represent the fractured mental state of a character losing their grip on reality. Along the same lines, it's curious that the visuals associated with the curse status effect in Dark Souls just so happen to involve the same crystalline formations. When you enter Seath's lair in the Crystal Cave, you see half a dozen black crystallized corpses in various poses of supplication, like those poor denizens of Pompeii whose death poses were immortalized in volcanic ash. Seath's breath raises crystal formations on the ground and inflicts curse. The link between the game's crystal iconography and the malady of curse seem to function as a wry repackaging of the familiar idea that knowing too much becomes a curse of its own. This certainly proved to be the case for Seath, one of the most tragic characters in a game already renowned for doling out tragedy with the heftiest of ladles. Good Grief, Trolls, Invaders, and the Shadow Self, by Jason Killingsworth. There's an overweight red phantom jogging up the steps of Sen's fortress. He's decked out in the bulky armor set of Black Iron Tarkus. The helmet and chest piece alone are sturdy enough to deflect an inbound asteroid, but Fat Tarkus also has a Black Iron Greatshield gripped in both hands, lending him the appearance of a human snowplow as he runs toward his destination. Fat Tarkus has not, however, invaded the world of Falcon 679 to run, or even to fight. He has come here to stand. His red aura, the signifier of all invading members of the Dark Wraith Covenant, glows continuously like a traffic light refusing to change. Fat Tarkus has come to troll, in an amusingly literal fashion, playing the part of a fairy tale bridge troll who will deny others passage. He settles into a doorway at the top of Sen's fortress through which this world's host must eventually pass in order to reach the area's boss and progress to On Orlando. But nobody's squeezing past Fat Tarkus, his raised great shield plying as bank vault doors you see in heist movies. And just like the criminal masterminds in those movies, Falcon 679's first attempt at cracking the barrier involves munitions. He conjures a pyromancy flame, runs up to Tarkus, and hurls it at him from point-blank range. The force of the explosion knocks Tarkus back slightly, but does virtually no damage, being almost entirely absorbed by the shield. The only impact, a tiny chunk of lost stamina, regens in seconds. Falcon 679 changes tactics and hurls a throwing knife, which ricochets off the shield with a shrill ping. Then he tries arrows, unleashing a steady barrage, but they too prove useless. The specter of a player from yet another world materializes briefly and dashes right through Tarkus as if to mock the host's predicament. Having come to terms with the impotence of his bow and arrows, Falcon 679 stands motionless, perhaps weighing his options. Then he kneels abruptly and uses the Black Separation Crystal, an item that, according to its menu description, sends phantoms back to their homes, or sends you back to yours. Nothing. Unfortunately for this desperate player, the crystal only banishes co-op summons from your world, not invaders. The nature of the standoff has turned Falcon 679's game of Dark Souls from an action RPG into a Monkey Island-style adventure game. He finds himself in one of that genre's trademark cul-de-sacs, no idea how to progress, scrutinizing every item in his inventory, wondering if there's a way in which one of them might be applied, like lubricating oil to the present stalemate. Out of ideas, he starts gesturing at Tarkus using the game's emote system. He waves like a chummy next-door neighbor. Then he beckons. He raises and lowers his shield with comical rapidity, as if a bit of counter-tomfoolery might weaken the troll's resolve. Fat Tarkus is unimpressed. Fat Tarkus has all day. Falcon 679 switches to two-handing his weapon and attacks. Nope. He regresses to failed tactics, letting fly another couple of throwing knives. Nope. He tries repeatedly to kick Fat Tarkus backwards out of the passage. Good luck with that. Approximately 15 minutes into the encounter, Falcon 679 starts jogging laps around the perimeter of the chamber, as if he's stuck in a prison yard and might as well exercise to pass the hours. At other times, he stands idle, facing Fat Tarkus. Skip forward to the 20-minute mark, and Falcon 679 has caught a fresh wind. He tries to hack and slash and huff and puff and blow Tarkus down. Dark Souls has taught this player, like it has the rest of us, that throwing yourself at any of the game's brick walls enough times will eventually allow you to punch through triumphantly, like the Kool-Aid Man in those old television commercials. But absolutely nothing is working. He's just stuck. He has no more ideas. Suddenly, Falcon 679 gets a private message, which reads in a string of all caps as chunky as the night blocking his path, "You have passed Fat Tarkus's test of patience. Please stand back to receive your reward." Back in game, Fat Tarkus proceeds to drop 5 units of humanity from his inventory in the doorway for Falcon 679 to collect, and finally, mercifully retreats from the doorway to let him pass. Moments later, the player controlling Fat Tarkus gets a notification on his own console. Falcon 679 has sent you a message. He opens this message from the person he's been stonewalling for the past 20 minutes. It reads simply, "Ha ha ha, beer spilt." As Tarkus triggers the black separation crystal to return to his world, Falcon 679 steps through the previously blocked doorway into the daylight outside and emotes a bow of the head as if to say, "Well trolled, sir." The actual human responsible for Fat Tarkus, Jeremy Greer, may troll occasionally, but he doesn't live under a bridge, unless somebody manages to construct a giant bridge over Lafayette, Louisiana after this book goes to press. He's a respectable southern gent, 35 years old, happily married, dog owner, a contributing member of society. He sells electronic reading systems to cities, municipalities, and public works. Quote, "I was a computer guy for years and years and then somehow got into sales because I have a personality," says Greer. "That's kind of what happens to guys like me." During our hour-long conversation, he laughs easily and often, and trust me, when the subject comes to PvP trolling tactics in Dark Souls, there's a lot to laugh about. I've tracked down Greer, who also co-hosts the wonderful Dark Insight podcast, to discuss numerous facets of Dark Souls PvP. I'm especially keen to understand the mindset of players who've latched on to the game's invasion mechanic. Members of the Dark Wraith Covenant have the ability to brute force their way into the games of other players and hunt them for sport. If an invader manages to kill you, they can derail your progress and force you to respawn at your most recent bonfire checkpoint. Or they can just stand in the doorway for 30 minutes holding a shield. Once inside another player's world, invaders can pass time however they like. I must confess up front, I've always had an irrational phobia around invasion. I've been invaded countless times over the hundreds of hours I've spent with Dark Souls, but I've never reciprocated. The ability for one party to force an unwilling participant into a duel made me squeamish. Anytime I unhallowed at a bonfire, rendering myself vulnerable to invasion, I instantly felt like I was walking to my car through an empty parking garage at night, gripping my Balder shield like keychain pepper spray. Unversed in the nuances of PvP tactics, I rarely offered invaders any meaningful challenge. Encounters were less of a duel and more of a let's get this over with turkey carving. Eventually, I began jumping off the nearest ledge if an invader ever showed up, the PvP equivalent of shouting, "You can't fire me, I quit." No matter how many times I died to the Capper Demon or Ornstein and Smo, I never felt inferior or judged by them, but it was impossible to get one-shotted by an invading player without a tinge of shame and inadequacy. Greer found his early encounters with invading Dark Wraiths as terrifying as I had, but instead of fleeing the experience, he simply decided to heed the internet meme that urges one to get good. Quote, "I've never played a lot of multiplayer games on the internet before Dark Souls," he says. "I'd played racing games and stuff like that, but nothing with an active competitive element to it. I remember my first time getting to On Orlando and going out to where the bridge would be, but I hadn't raised it yet. Someone left me a message there that said, 'Beware of Dark Wraith.' I remember not understanding at all what a Dark Wraith was, just holding my shield up and spinning the camera in a silly circle, expecting something to attack me. The first couple times I was invaded, it was a terrifying experience, and I thought, I bet it's a lot more fun if you're on the other side of that. And it was absolutely true. It was a lot more fun." After such a negative experience on the receiving end of invasion, did he have any qualms about turning around and becoming the aggressor? Quote, "Well, I didn't view it as a negative," says Greer. It was terrifying and it was scary, and the actual fight didn't last very long, but it was kind of thrilling at the same time. I was like, oh wow, this game has a whole side I haven't seen before. So you invade somebody and you die almost immediately because you can't heal and you have no idea what you're doing, but then you go online and you see videos of these people doing awesome things and you're like, okay, I could probably get better at this. And then you start getting a little bit more practice, and all of a sudden you spend 8 hours on a Saturday morning doing nothing but Dark Souls PvP. Greer found himself craving the unpredictability of human-controlled opponents. He'd already completed the game and proven that he had what it took to outwit the lines of code governing enemy attack patterns. He'd gotten an adrenaline rush out of developing the mechanical skills necessary to face roll through PvE, but human players were, as you'd expect, less exploitable, more dynamic in their item builds and combat choices. He'd uncovered a level of depth and complexity that only really shone in PvP encounters. There's an arms race that prevents you from ever declaring victory in any definitive sense. The enjoyment for Greer wasn't confined to the journey of mechanical mastery. PvP became sort of a Fashion Week front row as well, if you want to be dizzied by the array of wardrobe options available in the Souls series, just spend a few minutes on fashionsouls.com. He noticed a steady parade of weapons he'd never encountered before, used in novel ways. He'd have a small epiphany seeing a weapon wielded unexpectedly in his opponent's offhand, opening a whole new range of attack possibilities. He viewed each new sparring partner as a potential mentor, there to teach him something that would raise his level of proficiency or expand his Dark Souls combat vocabulary. He was internalizing a form of sign language that involved the whole body, a language of which PvE had only taught him the rudiments. Greer made friends, too. This fact shouldn't be surprising given the natural intimacy of fighting. Fighting another person is simply a couple's dance that ends with a bloody nose instead of a smooch. It's not arbitrary the way the beats of a stage fight are referred to as fight choreography, or that people refer to fights as taking two to tango. Once you learn the moveset of a boss and the tells for all the attacks, fighting that boss feels poetic in a way, a seamless dovetailing that takes you from one corner of the floor to the other. He steps right, you dive left, he dashes forward, you parry, he crouches to unleash an AoE, you lunge clear. But PvP adds to the broth an element of improvisation and stylistic co-expression. Step, ball, change. Quote, when you're invading the same spot for a couple of hours straight, you'll eventually run into people that are hanging out there to be invaded, he tells me. So I've made friends online. We'll see each other and we'll wave in the game and we know how the other person fights. Just like in a normal fighting game, you'll start being able to exploit their tactics. Like, this dude always does a light attack after he rolls back twice, or this person always tries to run over here, and I can go over there to try and exploit it. The beautiful thing about such intimacy is that it needn't only apply to getting in the head of a dueling partner or proving one's ability to impede another's progress via invasion. You can feel connected and important to other Dark Souls players via altruistic co-op gestures. The way in which both extremes tickle the brainstem seems like kind of a yin and yang, the tar-black heart of an invasion a perfectly balanced complement to the white knighthood of the game's co-op. Heat and cold, light and dark. Quote, I would invade a new Londo, says Greer with an almost sheepish tone in his voice. I would invade somebody, I would knock them off the ledge into the water, or they would die, and then I'd get a message. I'd open it up, expecting the person to be like, bleep, 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 and a whole lot of swears, but what it would actually be like is, hey man, can you help me against the four kings? And I'd be like, yeah, I can do that. So I'd drop the summon sign down and help the person I just killed do the level. Being a PvP dick is fine, but I also like helping people kill bosses because that's a lot of fun as well. I had just as much fun with the PvP magic build murdering Ornstein and Smough for people as I did murdering people on the way to Ornstein and Smough. Greer pauses for a moment before revising his previous statement. Not just as much fun, but I had fun. When I started writing this chapter, I set out to find an honest-to-cath PvP dick, to borrow Greer's phrase. I was Clarice Starling in search of my own Hannibal Lecter, a diabolical serial invader who could help me understand the mind of other serial invaders, somebody who stayed up nights fueled by the imagined torment of his victims, someone who carried about a stockpile of humanity and simultaneously none at all. I turned to the Book of the Guilty, an item in Dark Souls designed to function like a hybrid of Santa's naughty list and an arcane leaderboard. When you invade someone's world as Darkwraith and kill them, they are given the option of indicting you, which adds to your sin tally. My wife calls the Book of the Guilty the biggest assholes in America, says Greer, laughing. She'd say, so people are just calling you an asshole and it's going into some official asshole book? And I'm like, that's actually accurate. That's exactly what's happening. It was fun for a while, too. For a while. Until the hackers showed up and ruined the integrity of the leaderboard by modifying their save data to artificially boost their sin score, which proved to be trivially easy on both the PC and console versions of Dark Souls. It's kind of perfect, really, if you stop to think about it. Of all the hacked leaderboards in existence, this one is the most accurate. Hackers telling a digital falsehood to augment their sin score, which almost makes the leaderboard legitimate again in a weird way. I was overcome by a desire to interview somebody in the book's guilty top 10, one of the biggest assholes in America, or Europe, or South Africa, or wherever they happen to be plying their hateful trade. I booted up my PC copy of Dark Souls and consulted the book, as if it were some kind of attendance roll call for a satanic black mass jotted down by none other than Aleister Crowley himself. I started making my way methodically down the top 10. Alts, Werewolf, Stewcat 916, Footsteps, et al. I attempted to find the relevant players by cross-referencing these IDs against the Steam database. No luck. Many of them returned no search results, claiming the IDs didn't exist. Others I was able to locate, but inexplicably their game libraries didn't contain Dark Souls. The more bland and generic the name, the less sad I was to hit an investigative dead end. But while searching for the Steam ID belonging to Remu's Armpits, number 9 in the Book of the Guilty, you let yourself hope. Disappointment followed. All of the players in the top 10 possess the maximum sin score, 60,000, Dark Souls' mark of the boast, if you like. If the players were going to risk a potential account ban to cheat on an exam, they'd at least give themselves full marks. So I decided to stroll down the list until I found people who fell just short of 60,000. A search for number 58 on the list, a bona fide sin star named Song Anonymous, proud owner of 59,999 sin points, led me to the profile of a player with 515 hours of gameplay logged in Dark Souls. I cross-referenced against Twitter and sent a message, asked him to drop me a line. To heighten in my odds, I followed the same protocol with number 72, a player named Nefutus, who had slightly fewer sin points, 59,933. But it racked up a mind-melting 1,089 hours played, not to mention an impressive 100% achievement completion. Nefutus got back to me quickly with a short but promising reply, offering to answer any questions I may have, drawing on his approximately 2,800 hours of PvP experience. I sent Nefutus a list of questions. He still hasn't responded. A cheat and a liar. Figures. Just what you'd expect from a person whose soul was sagging beneath the weight of 59,933 units of sin. Songnonymous was more forthcoming. Toby Anderson, aka Songnonymous, is an 18-year-old student and aspiring writer based in Sweden, doing his final year of pre-university studies. I find him friendly and forthcoming, with an endearing, nerdy sense of humor built around hyperbole, which he double-underlines via theatrical emphasis in his speech. He lingers on provocative phrases, sounding wholly self-conscious. He knows I've reached out to him because I'm looking for a deviant personality, and he treats me as part journalist, part community theater casting director. I hope you got lucky with the Souls fans, he tells me, after I describe this book and its interest in the Dark Souls community, because there are some of them that are not very, how should I say, nice. I should know. I've killed a lot of them. Are you one of the nice ones or one of the shady ones, I ask. Well, as part of the PvP community, I'd say I'm one of the nicer people, says Anderson. Like, I won't kill someone if they're fighting an NPC or someone else. That's just not fun. I don't enjoy doing that. But I'm still a scumbag because I jump into other people's games and murder them. Similar to Greer's experience, the first time Anderson was invaded also happened to be in On Orlando during his first playthrough. The invading phantom positioned himself on the narrow ledge that leads around the side of the cathedral by the infamous great bow-wielding silver knights blocking his advance. The red phantom waved cheekily. Undaunted, Anderson proceeded to kick the invader off the ledge and waved back, eliciting a direct message calling him a scumbag for doing so. It's hard to demonize anybody for trolling in a Souls game when Miyazaki himself admits to placing that particular archer in the location best suited to knocking players to their death. It's like a Dark Souls reenactment of the famous 1987 anti-drug PSA. Answer me, who taught you how to do this stuff? You, alright? I learned it by watching you. To this day, kicking people off cliffs remains Anderson's favorite PvP troll tactic. It's just so humiliating, he says with an obvious relish. You can't do anything. You just get stunlocked off a bridge or something by someone who's running around with no armor, just a shield on his back, and he's kicking you in the face multiple times. It's great to be able to do such terrible things and win. When Miyazaki designed the invasion mechanic, which first appeared in Demon's Souls, he had his own Pandora's Box concerns about giving players the freedom to bring chaos and havoc into the lives of their fellow players. How much anarchy do you permit before your game turns into Lordran of the Flies? Quote, I did worry about the consequences of creating that opportunity for trolling, and I still do, he admits. I like games with gaps, spaces that allow the users to be resourceful and make discoveries and invent their own ways to enjoy the game. So if a player uses Chameleon to inventively fool an opponent, or someone leaves a message that leads you leaping to your doom, then, in my mind, they're doing justice to the Dark Souls style of fun. But there are cases where it goes too far, and the player on the receiving end is not given a fair shake. This is an example of failing in my goal of using online play to distill the fascinating aspects of humans and human society. Back to the drawing board. When I ask Anderson what keeps him coming back to Dark Souls PvP after hundreds of hours, he ponders silently for a moment. I guess it was just the invasion himself, he says. Knowing that you're in someone else's world and you're there to ruin their entire existence for a couple of minutes. You can basically do whatever you want and they can't do anything about it. I love being in control like that. It's fun. The actual fighting is not as much fun as ruining someone else's day. What is fun to you about ruining someone else's day? I ask, trying to sound as non-judgmental as possible. I imagine myself as a distinguished psychiatrist, inquisitive and unflustered by my patient's sociopathic declaration. I guess it's kind of revenge for what I had to suffer through when I was a noob, says Anderson. Like, I know how it is to be invaded and killed when you're new to the game, and so I just want to put other people through that kind of misery. Do you feel like the Dark Souls equivalent of the kid who was raised in a violent home and grew up to be violent, I asked? Yeah, I do, he says. I mean, I'm not a very violent person in real life. I act like a douchebag in Dark Souls because I don't want to go to jail in real life. You can put it like that. On a bad day, I'd say I'm going to stay up all night nonstop ruining people's lives. Have you done that? I ask, trying to suss out if it's just another bit of sporting hyperbole. Yes, but never when I've had school, he replies. Just during the weekends. That last statement from Anderson perfectly embodies the schism between the virtual menace prodding at the freedom built into Dark Souls systems and the conscientious human being outside the game world who wants to make sure he gets enough rest to be able to function in school the next day. It reminded me of a similar topic of discussion that arose during my conversation with Jeremy Greer about the disconnect between the adult hovering outside Dark Souls and the mischievous avatar fooling around inside. I'm a super nice guy, Greer told me. I know a salesperson would say that, but in my personal interactions with people, I never get mad. I never get upset. I never call people bad names. I'm a really laid-back and chill dude, but there was something so tempting about invasion in Dark Souls. It was like the dark side, if you want to apply the Star Wars metaphor to it. You're like, oh shit, they've got Force Lightning? I want Force Lightning. Invasion brought out that evil side in me for some reason. It was a lot of fun. I look back on playing Dark Souls PvP with a lot of fond memories. I spent time in the Tomb of the Giants trying to invade people for a while because if you're going to be a dick, go all out, right? Did you ever look at your trolliest exploits and think, who the hell is that guy? I ask. Absolutely, he replied without hesitation. But in the back of your head, you're like, that guy is kind of always there, but you don't let him out because that's not a good guy. Nobody wants to see that dude. Maybe the human psyche functions like a simulation of Dark Souls running on the brain. Thoughts invade like red phantoms uninvited, one after another, day in, day out. Some are full of spite and retaliation. Some bow and give you a chance to top off your health before the duel begins. Some simply pop in to make you spill your beer laughing, then drop a gift of humanity. But the reality is that every phantom evaporates at some point and gets kicked back to whatever world it came from. Outside the fantasy's surface membrane, you're noble and safe regardless. The invaders can't touch you. 7 days after my conversation with Songnonymous, I realized that I never asked him if his Book of the Guilty entry was legitimate or a hack like all those others, so I sent him a message to ask. A few minutes later, I get a two-word reply. It's legit. If true, he's a rogue, but at least an honorable one. And with a score of 59,999, that means he's one single point from Dark Souls' level cap of pure, irredeemable evil. That's just one more indictment, which ought to be trivially easy to acquire. I'm going to let myself imagine that Dark Souls doesn't allow anyone playing by the rules to hit the 60,000 cap. If you've murdered thousands of adventurers but resisted temptation in one key respect, it would stand as a testament to the fact that there's still a drop of goodness left. There's hope for him. For all of us, yet. A Tour of Lordran, Darkroot Garden, and Valley of the Drakes, by Jason Killingsworth. I'm not obligated to uphold any pretense of objectivity here, so let me just say Darkroot is my favorite area in all of Dark Souls. I find it so easy to imagine the feel of the damp, spongy earth underfoot. The pervasive quiet feels both duvet-safe and primed for horror. Magical, iridescent white flowers planted throughout the stage glow reassuringly, illuminating one's carefully preceding footfall. Though removed by a fair distance from the Duke's archives in Crystal Cave, we find in Darkroot Garden and Darkroot Basin shared DNA strands. Crystal golems, the boss version of Seath's moonlight butterfly creation, evidence of sorcery and enchantment. One of the game's most impressive feats is how it takes the most wooden of fantasy genre conventions and pulls a Pinocchio-like vivification. Welcome to Dark Souls' spellbinding take on the Enchanted Forest. Speaking of wooden things come to life, beware the demonic foliage that rises ent-like from the forest floor and shakes the soil from its branches before attempting to wallop you with outstretched limbs. The magic holding sway in Darkroot appears to have a similar effect on other entities in this same area. You'll witness giant suits of armor covered in moss and looking as if they've been buried in the forest floor for decades climb to their feet when you approach. I used to laugh at the absurdity of those mushroom dudes padding around the swamp near the enchanted ember, but now it strikes me as internally consistent. If the magic in this area is possessing and anthropomorphizing foliage elsewhere in the garden, why not mushrooms? Then again, as in Super Mario Bros., including mushrooms in your game when trippy shit is going down always strikes me as a sensible design call. Also, let's just take a second to appreciate the work of whichever artist at From Software painted the knuckles of the mushroom parent's fists with blood splatter, signaling that these foes' lazy haymakers connect like a medieval battering ram knocking on a castle's front gate. The winding cliff ledge path that leads from the higher ground of Darkroot Garden to the basin below adds a sense of geographical progression and dynamic contrast. You'll hear jazz musicians talk about how playing the rests in the music can be just as important as hitting the notes surrounding them. In Dark Souls, more spacious arenas such as Darkroot Basin provide a necessary counterpoint to the highly crafted arteries through which you pass in the game's maze-like sequences. But there's another ingenious aspect to Darkroot Basin's layout. With the imposing Hydra occupying a lake at the far end of the area, you create a sublimely gradual tension ramp. Torpedoes of water come rocketing across the map, alerting you to something not entirely clear at first. The careful approach to the Hydra makes your encounter with it all the more momentous. On the other side of a cave tunnel cutting through Darkroot Basin's cliff, you'll find Valley of the Drakes, a narrow bit of connective map ligament that lodges in the memory due to the dramatic chasm that cuts through its middle and the lightning-spitting drakes patrolling its confines. There's a giant undead dragon slumped over the cliff's edge, looking haggard and partially decomposed. As he succumbs helplessly to even the most timid ranged attacks, it's hard not to feel a stab of regret. No bard ever spun verse about a warrior putting an age-withered beast out of its misery. Similarly and sublimely melancholic, the two bosses inhabiting Darkroot each have their own way of making your heart ache. The Moonlight Butterfly does it with music, deviating from the game's usual climactic moment soundtrack, what game critic Ollie Welsh exquisitely described in his review of Dark Souls as the appalled shriek of a chamber choir. You instead get an otherworldly siren lullaby. This scene is pure video game hypnosis, the metronomic rhythm of the butterfly's slow beating wings, the glittering particles hovering around its body, the lilt of the soloist's aria. Dying to the moonlit butterfly feels like expiring peacefully in one's bed or surrendering to death in a winter wood as the elements draw a white shroud over your body. The moonlit butterfly is beautiful, and there's a dramatic tension in being asked to kill something that angelic. As for the other boss, the great Grey Wolf Sith guards the grave of his slain companion Artorias, a noble act which inspires empathy before a single blow has been dealt by either party. Once you've flogged Sif to a tiny bit of health remaining, the once regal creature begins limping around the arena, drawing one of its front paws off the ground as if there's a thorn lodged in it. Then, like in Shadow of the Colossus, you're expected to finish the deed, even though the behemoth earmarked for extermination looks pitiable. So few combat-driven games ever force players to confront the reality of remorse, and even among the few that do, the percentage that actually hit the note in an emotionally resonant fashion is vanishingly small. There's no way to walk away from Sith at this point. You kill him, or he kills you. Dark Souls expects you to fight, but let's take a moment to appreciate the fact that it also expects you to feel. In a game full of sketchbook monstrosities, Sif is just a wolf, albeit a towering one with a sword in his mouth. Still, he reminds us of our canine companions outside of the game, of man's best friend. We ruefully put him down. Tough Love, on Dark Souls Difficulty, by Keza McDonald. Dark Souls' most obvious trait also happens to be its least interesting. Fixating on, gosh, this game's hard, seems a bit obvious when we could be talking about its themes, its lore, its fascinating game design. Dark Souls is more than a tough mutter challenge for the couch-bound. But Dark Souls' difficulty is also inescapable, and rightly or wrongly, it's what the game is most famous for. Ask players for their recollections, and they will tell you the moments that made them cry, or the moments where they felt physically and mentally broken by a boss fight, the moments where they nearly gave up. And if you dig a little deeper, examining Dark Souls' difficulty yields a lot of insight into what makes it work. If a game's punishingly hard, people tend to just give up on it. We've all been there, throwing the controller at the floor after the 12th attempt at some badly checkpoint level or irritating boss. What is it about Dark Souls that makes us persevere? Is there something essentially masochistic in the makeup of a Souls fanatic? Of course, some people do just give up. The breaking point for many arrives somewhere before the 10-hour mark. Often it's the Taurus Demon. On my own first run through the game, I spent 4 hours hacking bravely away at Taurus's heels on that bridge, having missed the helpful tutorial about plunge attacks back in the Undead Asylum. When I finally beat him, using a rusty dagger on that narrow platform, I nearly cried with relief. Though I actually did cry when, weeks later after the game had come out, I discovered how easy that whole process could have been if I had just climbed the ladder and dropped on his head. Most Dark Souls players can name the moment they broke through the wall. You need one big, hard-won victory to cement the cycle of effort, frustration, reward, and release that drives people through the game. That first big victory, where you face something that seemed impossible at first and conquered it after hours of failure and death and learning, is also necessary before you come to understand the core idea at the heart of Dark Souls' design, death as education. This is, of course, not conventional game design. Conventional game design eases players into an experience, gradually introducing new concepts and abilities before putting you in any real danger, rather than dropping you right into a world full of things that are trying to kill you as swiftly and horribly as possible and watching you get on with it. This type of game design relies upon trusting the player to persevere, to learn from dying and try again, rather than just put down the controller and walk away, and it's baked into every design decision in Dark Souls. Every death presents an opportunity for reflection and improvement. Even the long run back from the bonfire to the fog gate before a boss domain offers an opportunity to contemplate where you went wrong last time. When Miyazaki took over the reins on Demon Souls, this concept of death as education was rather difficult to explain because, well, it hadn't been done before. As we've mentioned, he and his producer from Sony, Takeshi Kaji, actually had to lie to the Sony higher-ups about it to get the game greenlit. Quote, "To be quite honest, we didn't really mention that aspect of the game when we did the presentations to Sony," Miyazaki told me back in 2011, on the day that Dark Souls was released in Japan. "We knew that people at the publisher would feel that it was too difficult and off-putting, and they'd use that to make us change it. So in the product concept presentations, I didn't talk about it much. Of course, I communicated with our producer at Sony, Kaji-san, but he actually agreed with me. Before Demons came out, both Sony and players would have thought, what the hell is he talking about, death is education? What is he thinking? But now everyone is aware of the concept. The main concept behind the death system is trial and error. The difficulty is high, but always achievable. everyone can achieve without all that much technique. All you need to do is learn from your deaths how to overcome the difficulties. Overcoming challenges by learning something in a game is a very rewarding feeling, and that's what I wanted to prioritize in Dark Souls and Demon's Souls. And because of the online gameplay systems, you can even learn something from somebody else's death. I'd say that was the main concept behind the online aspects, too. Miyazaki makes an often overlooked point about technique. You don't need to be an enormously skilled gamer to play Dark Souls, though it certainly helps if you go for a close-quarter style of play, especially. The range of weapons, magic, and techniques that Dark Souls accommodates means that if you're not finding much success with an enormous sword, you're encouraged to experiment with other approaches. Because of the way the game communicates and asks you to learn, anyone can play it as long as they're willing to persevere and adapt. Quote, I come down on the side saying that Dark Souls isn't especially difficult. It's just extremely punishing, says Jamie Madigan, a psychologist and big Dark Souls fan who specializes in the intersection of games and psychology. If you don't do something correctly, you're dead. Once you figure things out, it's not especially difficult. Probably more so than a lot of games, but it's not on the level of Super Meat Boy or Ori and the Blind Forest or some of those maso-core platforming games, and it's not as difficult in the same way that playing a competitive first-person shooter against a really skilled and experienced team is difficult and frustrating. Dark Souls does require manual dexterity and twitch reflexes, but it's also pretty obvious in its feedback. I think one of the appealing things about it from a psychology perspective is that we only learn and are motivated to pursue goals to the extent that we get feedback about what we're doing. Dark Souls provides pretty clear, immediate, and useful feedback, which our brains are designed to pay attention to and make use of. Understanding the psychology of Dark Souls and what it does to our brains is the key to understanding why its version of difficulty is so rewarding and absorbing, where difficulty in other games is just frustrating and off-putting. One of the key psychological models behind human motivation is something called self-determination theory, which posits that for a person to persist and feel motivated by an activity, it has to satisfy three different needs: mastery, autonomy, and relatedness. Dark Souls offers mastery in spades, in that you always feel like you're getting better. Autonomy is the feeling that you're free to make choices, and that those choices are meaningful, which Dark Souls also accommodates. And finally, there's relatedness, the feeling of connectedness to people. And that's one of the things that prevents Dark Souls' difficulty from being too demoralizing. It has a sense of community. You know that you're going through it with thousands of other people too, and seeing their messages and ghostly presences in your own game helps you feel like you're not alone. It's also important to feel like we have control. Unfair difficulty is never fun. And though some deaths in Dark Souls are unexpected, they're rarely inexplicable and are usually your fault. If you play through the same sections over and over again, as most people have to, you come to realize there is fundamentally almost no randomness in Dark Souls. The environment and enemies always behave in the same way. It's what you do that changes, and the predictability of everything else makes mastery possible. Quote, if there's no clear relationship between what you do and what the outcome is, it's not as motivating to play because you don't feel like you're accumulating any mastery, Jamie explains. You don't feel like anything you do has a direct result. So I think that's one reason why Dark Souls is so appealing. Once you start to learn it, it's essentially predictable. Over the course of writing this book, one thing I've heard over and over again from Dark Souls players is that because of the high stakes, both victory and defeat feel more meaningful. This is something that especially appeals to people who have been playing games for decades, because since the early 2000s, games have generally been trending away from that kind of challenge. Dark Souls translator Ryan Morris sums it up, quote, Dark Souls put the significance of things that were happening back into games. Like, you have to care about dying when your souls are on the line. You have to assess a situation and figure out if it's really worth taking the risk and doing it. And so it keeps you on the edge of your seat because your time investment in that game is actually a risk, so you get spooked and freaked out. That physical component to the Dark Souls experience, the sweating palms, the racing heart, the cold, nauseating dread when you fall victim to a little gang of hollows on your way back to a bonfire and lose 20,000 souls, intrigued me. Other games are exciting, sure, but I don't think I've ever leapt up and screamed at the television, arms raised in jubilation, while playing any other game. The way you feel during the final minutes of those tight boss fights, where both you and your foe are millimeters from death and you've been holding your breath for seemingly minutes at a time, is not something most video games are capable of eliciting. We have that reaction whenever we reach any sort of goal in life, a goal that you've been working toward and applying things you've learned, Jamie says. It's in proportion to the amount of energy and effort you've invested. You have an endorphin release not dissimilar to what you'd have with an orgasm. When you reach a goal, your brain releases a chemical that makes you feel happy and satisfied. In video games, probably a lot like in sports, there's a feedback system. When you're doing something demanding, your heart rate goes up, your skin galvanizes, and you start to perspire and breathe faster. You have all these physiological reactions. And there's a lot of research in psychology literature showing that those things can feed on each other and cycle back. You're excited, and because you're excited, your heart rate goes up, and you become aware that your heart rate has gone up, and you interpret that as evidence that you're excited, so you get more excited, and your heart rate goes up more. And these physiological and psychological systems go back and forth. It's possible to trick people into this kind of feedback loop, of course. Consider the insidiously addictive but not meaningfully rewarding appeal of slot machines and less scrupulous free-to-play games, for example. But it's difficult to fake for long. If achievements are illusory, we become wise to it and the thrill dissipates. Because Dark Souls keeps the stakes consistently high, its thrill does not noticeably dissipate. Well, certainly not until you're past your first few playthroughs. For all the suffering that Dark Souls has inflicted upon us, it's rarely totally demoralizing. There's always something else to try, or someone to turn to in search of help. And even when they're smacking you in the face with your own incompetence, you get the impression that From's designers are often doing so with a cheeky smile on their face rather than a sadistic grimace. Dark Souls' sense of humor is greatly underappreciated. In what other game can you get punched to death by a mushroom? It's all tied in with the difficulty level, Miyazaki said back on the day of Dark Souls' release. The development team did think it might be funny to design, for instance, an area where you're forced to play on a tiny little beam with traps everywhere. It's hard, but never impossible, and there is that element of humor, that people might laugh when they get killed, that they might feel caught out by the game. The game design is intended to be such that you don't feel frustration, but instead feel understanding, the urge to try again. And that'll do it for this episode of Codex Radio. Please send your feedback regarding the show to me at endless_odyssey on Twitter, or to the show's Twitter account at codex_radio, or you can email the show at codexpodcast@myriadtruths.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.